We're going to get going. Members apologize for a couple minutes late. We don't have a quorum yet, but I believe Mr. Meyer is going to start on reviewing the rest of House File 2153 that we have not gone through yet. Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. House File 2153, we have talked about several pieces already. This is the department's policy technical bill, rather than have all these individual proposals move forward as separate bills. This year we just combined a bunch of small technical pieces. I'm going to be working off of a fact sheet that I believe you have in your packet. It says 2012 policy fact sheet, omnibus technical bill. Article 1 of the bill would provide us the authority to do short-term cash flow advances for executed grants or contracts associated with land acquisitions. Sometimes we get to the point where the dollars aren't available, or we don't have the dollars appropriated currently for an acquisition to take place that may be scheduled for closing. This would allow us to do a short-term advance of payments for that. Section 2 repeals a report for the Forest for the Future revolving account. This removes the annual reporting requirement related to the forest land purchases supported by and sales providing revenue into the revolving account. There's a number of these reports that we are repealing. This information can and will be available to the legislature at any time.
Members, I'd like to bring the Environment, Energy, Natural Resources Committee to order. And Representative Quam, I'm wondering if you could move the minutes from yesterday.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the minutes.
Discussion to the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The minutes are approved and were in order. Go ahead, Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Section 3 on the bottom of page 2, apprentice rider validation. We're talking about establishing an I Can Ride program similar to our other programs that we have, like I Can Camp and things like that, whereby a person would be able to participate in a DNR-sanctioned snowmobile or ATV event within a state park or a state recreation area, for example, to see if they do like it, enjoy it, and then after that point in time, they would need to have the validations and training provided to them through that program. Section 4 of the bill deals with technical changes on snowmobiles and ATV languages, and it is extremely technical. You can see on page 3, lines 3.17, we're striking the word "the" and adding "a." So there's been some confusion amongst people that if you were prosecuted for an act of against the law of snowmobile or ATV use, that you couldn't ride the snowmobile or the machine that you were actually caught violating law on. This just says you can't use any snowmobiles or ATVs. So it's a rather technical change. Sections 5 and 6 and 7 of the bill deal with our AIS language that we've talked about already. Actually, Section 8 does. No, I'm sorry. Section 8 is different. But those 5, 6, and 7s are in our AIS language that we've talked about at previous meetings, Mr. Chairman. That brings us to page 7. Section 8 would allow for the use of a grant and aid trail to be used by motorized and non-motorized. This provision enables for combined use where it's warranted and safety can be maintained. We're getting into situations where people want to have multimodal trails, and this would allow for that to occur. Section 9, Mr. Chairman, in going through our fee schedules, our fine schedules for some of the parks and trails events, it was recognized by staff that penalties in certain areas are in statute as a misdemeanor, but actually on the fine schedules they're being charged as petty misdemeanors. So we thought it would be a good thing to clarify that in statute that these aren't misdemeanors, rather they're petty misdemeanors. So Section 9 clarifies that any violations of rules within state trails or forests, parks, monuments, or state rec areas and waysides are petty misdemeanors unless a different penalty for the act is otherwise imposed by statute. Section 10 is also clarifying that for the horse trail pass that it would be a petty misdemeanor rather than a misdemeanor. Section 11 is our aquatic invasive species discussion again. Section 12 as well. Section 13 is the same language that we had for snowmobiles and ATVs for enforcement, striking the word "the" and inserting "a." Section 14 is a technical change that just clarifies that when a person who fails to appear in court or comply with orders of the court for a violation of game and fish laws, that they will have their game and fish license or permit privileges suspended. You can see the new language. Has failed to appear in court, and it used to say under a summons issued, we're inserting in response to a notice to appear or fails to comply with other orders of the court regarding the appearance of proceedings. Section 15, again, Mr. Chairman, is from our VHS or our AIS bill, talking about processing of bait for VHS or I guess you don't need to know the technical term. You're probably all familiar with that. Section 16, again, is repealing a report from our Lands and Minerals, Lands Records Management System. This is a report that would be presented on the outcomes of the Land Records Management System. Again, it's redundant language. We can provide these updates. We always provide periodic updates to members and the committee whenever they're asking for those. Section 17 is a clarification of an appropriation from, I believe it was 2010, from the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund, just clarifying that for this project, we can use the woody byproduct material, we can do grants, and we can sell material from public or private property to markets and use those dollars back for the program. We did discuss this at the Environment and Natural Resources, or I should say the LCCMR meeting last week. And I believe there was a motion to move forward with that, Mr. Chairman. Section 18, you can see again, is striking a report on, I believe that's the ATV grant program or ATV ambassador program. Just getting rid of a reporting piece there. Section 19, Mr. Chairman, deals with Lake LaSalle State Rec Area, and it's just a clarification of hunting and fishing seasons. So we're clarifying that hunting, fishing, and trapping of protected species are allowable activities during designated seasons at the Lake LaSalle State Rec Area. Section 20, the repealer, if folks look at the fact sheet here, it outlines what these repealers are. One is this Natural Resource Asset Preservation and Replacement Report. Nursery and Tree Improvement Plan, this report is submitted annually. Timber Harvest Plan, we have such a public involvement process now in our timber harvest plans and harvesting guidelines that the report, I think, we feel is redundant. The same way for the Lifetime Fishing and Wildlife Trust Fund report, that's contained within the Game and Fish Fund Budget Oversight Committee annual report. And the Stream Protection and Improvement Loan Program, there's no funding for this program, so this reporting requirement is obsolete. Mr. Chairman, we are going to have a separate lands bill, but that lands bill will focus just on the parcels of land, I believe. So there's several policy pieces in here I'm going to go over relatively quickly. Article 2, the road easements across state lands. This would allow the commissioner to convey road easements on school trust fund lands to private parties with easement terms limited to 50 years. Currently, we can convey these to townships and local units of government, which then in turn convey them or get into an agreement with the private property owner. We've done this several times via statute for several coincidences or issues, and we just like to make sure, clarify that this is an allowable use of these, and we have talked about that with School Trust Fund Advisory Committee. Section 2 of the bill of this article, page 18, would strike the requirement to have legislative approval on riparian land sales. The department feels that since land sales and land management is an important piece of our mission, not only acquire lands but trust fund lands, this will allow us to move faster on our land asset management plans and also to protect these lands and get some lands off of the tax rolls. Onto the tax rolls, I should say, and also improve the management of some of those lands. Section 3 deals with Lease terms and changing the terms of leases on DNR administered lands from 10 years to 21 years, just to bring it in the same time frame as other leases that are out there. After that, beginning on page 20.9 through the rest of the bill, Mr. Chairman, are the specific land parcels of the bill that we're looking to. We have a number of tracts of state park we're deleting to or adding to, and some directed sales. I know there are some other bills that are out there that will be also discussed on tax forfeit land sales and things like that. That is the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And just to remind members, the lands part of it, I believe Representative Hancock is putting in a bill that will carry the non-controversial land things, or hopefully they'll all be non-controversial by the time we get to the end. And a few of you have mentioned that you have individual bills, so if you could consult with Representative Hancock on that. And I anticipate we'll probably do, last year, if I remember right, Representative Hilty and Representative Fabian, I think it was at that time, got together with a subgroup to hear the lands issues with Ms. Lewis from DNR. And we'll, I anticipate that we'll do the same thing again. So all members, if you have lands bills, if you can make sure you get them entered, and then we'll hear them in conjunction to roll them into Representative Hancock's bill. Representative Wagenius, did I see you have a hand up? Maybe I was anticipating. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How do you want to proceed on this? I have questions on five sections. Would you like me to ask questions on one section or five? Or
Representative Wagenius, you can do as you please. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On section 9 of this, you are talking about willfully causes destruction of resources, changing that from to a petty misdemeanor from a misdemeanor. And my question is, what do you do now when somebody causes willful destruction of resources? Do you have them reimburse state taxpayers?
Mr. Chairman,
Meyer.
Representative Wagenius, members, that would all depend on what they do. I think the case of the people, the one that sticks out in my head most vividly right now is the damage that occurred at Afton State Park, vandalism to some camper cabins and things like that this past summer. They did have to. We are seeking damages to restore those activities. So, yes, we do have that authority as well. Probably the language on the fact sheet, willfully causes destructions of resources, is a little bit strong for what we're talking about. It's just taken from the statute where it says shall willfully cut, injure, or destroy any live tree, shrub, timber, evergreen, or ornamental plant or any kind, or who shall willfully injure, remove, destroy, deface, or mutilate any guideboard, guidepost, furniture, fixture. There is restitution as well on those things. What we're trying to do is have the fee schedule. Once we establish a penalty in law, the AIS, or that's probably establishing actually those penalties in statute, but we have a category, right? Misdemeanor or petty misdemeanor class of violation. We then go to the court system and they develop a fine schedule with what they think is the appropriate penalty for that activity. Many of these things on the current fine schedules within the courts are fined under the petty misdemeanor guidelines. So we're trying to clarify that that's what they are actually. So, but where there are civil or where there are damages involved, we will seek restitution as well.
Representative Wagenius, sorry to interject, but you asked about, you said you had it on five sections. I would like to discuss all the bills separate of AIS. I know Director Hirsch is here and enforcement is also here about enforce or about the AIS stuff. Mr. Meyer is double booked in two rooms, so I'd like to do everything separate of AIS. Then I believe we'll release Mr. Meyer and go into the AIS stuff. Representative Wagenius, I didn't know if the five sections included AIS.
Mr. Chairman, I have to go back and look for a second, but no, I don't think they do. What I am concerned about, obviously, is making sure that by changing to petty misdemeanor, we do not impair in any way our ability to have people reimbursed for what's going on, I mean, what they've done. And I think a lot of times people do this petty kind of stuff because they think it's too bothersome for the state to go after them, which is not probably a good.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McGinnis, that's not the intent here. I will get back to you with some more information on that. That's more specific to that line of questioning.
Okay. Representative McGinnis.
Thank you. Okay. The next question I have is on Section 19. When you say hunting, fishing, and trapping, is that on the whole LaSalle Lake Recreation Area, or just, I mean, I can understand most of it, but during hunting season, are folks who would come to that area who are not hunters kind of virtually excluded because they're not hunting?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lugenius, it would not be on the entire process. We still have guidance in areas where there's no discharge, no hunting, for example, around the park facilities. That is, it's all done. It's all posted and signed. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Just
Representative Lugenius,
clarifying that. I'm looking at now section one on. Page, this is the lands policy on road easements. And this is across school trust lands. Now, if I'm listening to the Utah model, they would, under the Utah model, if you're somebody is taking advantage of school trust lands, they would be charged and money would go into the school trust account. Is that, I see that you're authorized to do it, but will you be charging?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lugenius, yes, there is a fee associated with this at a fair market value. What we're trying to do is here just clarify that, and actually this is to generate more revenue for the trust land. Rather than right now, if it's acquired land or tax forfeit lands, we can issue these leases to a private individual for a term of 50 years. We want to make sure we can do that on trust fund lands as well, rather than convey it to, in the case of the last one we've dealt with, that it was up in northeastern Minnesota, we had to convey it to a township, and then they went back and conveyed it to the landowners. It's just a cleaner way to do it. Probably generate a little bit more revenue off of it that way.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's good to hear. My second question is, how do you determine the lease payment at a 50-year for 50 years? Do you have an acceleration clause in it? How do you do that so that, I mean, a dollar today and a dollar 50 years from now? We have no clue.
Mr. Chairman, I'm about to get back to you on that, Representative Lugenius. I need to talk with Lands and Minerals on exactly how that's done. It's based on fair market value, but I understand what you're looking at. What are the accelerators or the increases, and how is that payment reviewed and what terms? But I'll get back to you on that.
Representative Lugenius.
Thank you. This provision of removing the provision that prohibits the sale of state lands bordering meandered lakes and other public waters and recourses, my guess is citizens would not like us to give DNR that authority. In fact, I have the sense that citizens would be furious if we were to do that. So we have, that's something we need to discuss. On Section 3, Mr. Chair, if I could go ahead.
Continue, Representative Wagenius.
I'm going to assume when you're changing the term of lease from 10 to 21 years, it's my same question. If you're going across trust fund lands and any lands, how do we make sure that the fee or charge is keeping up to date.
Mr. Chair, I will get, actually, my answers I'll provide to the entire committee on those questions. So we have those.
You can always make that assumption, Mr. Meyer, if a member of the committee requests information, that we all want to see it. Representative Wagenius.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Those are my questions for now.
Well, thank you, Representative Wagenius. Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meyer, could you explain in Section 3 of Article 2, page 19, what's going on with respect to peat plans?
Mr. Meyer.
Section 3. Is that the same thing we were just talking about, the lease terms?
Well, Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meyer, what I'm wondering about is the change on line 30, including a term non-agricultural purposes, and then striking the language on lines 32 and 33.
Mr.
Chairman,
page 19.
Representative Hilty, that's a technical change that I need to get more information on from Lands and Minerals on exactly why they want to do that. I don't have that answer with me right now. So we view it as a technical thing, but I'll provide more detail for you on that.
Thank Representative you. Hilty.
That's it, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meyer, I do have a question there on page 19 as well. The deletion of the peatlands and for agricultural purposes, I'd like kind of a definition on how the agency defines agricultural purposes, what that may be entailing. Okay. I appreciate that it's technical, so all right.
I'll get back to that.
Can I just ask both Representative Fabian and Representative Hilty, do you want Mr. Meyer to bring in the next time the bill's back someone that can address this, or do we want to first see if he is able to address it via email?
To that point, Mr. Chair, I guess what I'm looking at there is you know, what is this going to change? What are we, by deleting this, what's going to change? Okay, and I'd like some specifics.
Representative Fabian, you still have the floor, but just 1 second. To all members and to Representative Hilty, you brought up this question, and I have asked the DNR to not necessarily bring everybody they think they might need to the meeting. So if you anticipate, if you get the email and you're thinking you need somebody here, like yesterday, Representative Hancock had some enforcement questions, so we have a couple of enforcement people here today. So if we can kind of be preemptive in that approach, that would be helpful. Thank you, Representative Hilty. Representative Fabian, you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then, Mr. Meyer, on page 17, on the road easement and the charges and the costs and so forth, I'd like a little information as to how these fees were arrived at, the amounts and so forth. And then also it says the commissioner has the shall assess the applicant a monitoring fee to cover the projected reasonable costs for monitoring the construction of the road. And then there's also some language in there that talks on lines 18.9 and 18.10 talks about the fees collected here, credit to the land management account, because these are school trust lands. Am I correct? I want to make sure on that. Is that going into
Mr. Meyer, are these school trust lands?
Mr. Chairman, the trust fund land revenue would go into the trust. What we're amending here is this general section, chapter 84.631. So it talks about all of our road easements that we have. Trust fund dollars that are generated off of trust funds automatically, they either go to the forest expense account or they go right into the corpus. So, but I can provide you more detail on that.
Mr. Meyer, this would affect both state lands that are school trust and non-school trust.
Mr. Chairman, members, currently we have the ability to do these leases on state lands, but we're trying to clarify that we can do this to a private person on trust lands as well.
Thank you. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then just a comment to Representative Wagenius, when you made the comment on page 18 about the public being, I don't remember exactly what the word was that you used to describe their feelings about selling state lands, I would disagree with you. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, just on that section,
Mr.
really
Meyer.
Quickly, this does not mean that we wouldn't provide a complete review of these lands and get recommendations from our various divisions on how to sell or if we should sell these lands. This just means that we wouldn't have to take that final step in coming back with legislative approval. So we would still review the lands, have our professional staff from each division make recommendations, and then take those under
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. Representative Purcell. I have Representative Purcell, Dill, and Wiggins. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meyer, just a little bit further in the clarification on the LaSalle recreation area situation, since that is within gunshot of where I might hunt. Those recreation, cabins, the park area, are they treated like residences then for, you know, how far you need to be away to discharge firearm?
Mr. Chairman, members,
Mr. Meyer,
that doesn't apply to that situation, but we have that area kind of sectioned off and signage was put up last fall. We were able to hunt there actually last November, I believe, for deer hunting season. And we're making sure that people aren't discharging firearms or hunting around the park. If you remember the maps of that area, there was a piece that was going to be the park piece of it. That area is posted no hunting, and I can provide maps of that too.
Just Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up. I mean, I'm assuming that if it is a park, though, that you're not supposed to discharge within so many feet of that, kind of like, you know, where there's people around that aren't hunters.
Mr. Meyer.
Chairman, Representative Purcell, yes, and that's our intention with that.
Representative Deal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meyer, how long has that been in statute about the riparian lands coming to legislative approval, and how many times has there been a problem when you came to the legislature and asked for authority, or a member had a bill? You know, I have many of those bills that have riparian. How many times has there been a problem at the legislative level getting approval? And I'm just wondering about that. I kind of have a tendency to agree with Representative
Wakenius
on this issue, so I just want a little more information.
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dill, I'm not sure about the history. I can get back to you on that. And in my time with the agency, I can remember probably two or three instances that we have proposed lands to be sold that were on riparian areas that the legislature would not approve that sale.
Representative Dill.
Did they all have to do with Representative Rocavina?
Mr. Meyer.
The ones that were mandated to sell, yes, but the ones no.
Follow up, Representative Dill.
No,
Representative Wiggins.
Well, thank you on this subject. I'm glad to hear that Representative Fabian's constituents have great confidence in DNR. I'm not sure that confidence is as pervasive as it is, obviously, in Representative Fabian's district. I think the public rather thinks that it's a good check that this comes from DNR to the legislature, and it doesn't seem to be an outlandish problem if it's only been two or three times that the legislature has said no. So given that these are public lands, and these are the kind of public lands that Minnesotans hold near and dear, I think it's a mistake for us to move forward on that.
Thank you, members. Thank you, Mr. Meyer. We'll have this bill back at some future point. If members have individual thoughts, issues on it, if they could contact Ms. Sipko and work with Mr. Meyer on the bill, that would be good. Next, we are going to, let's do the AIS part. Mr. Hirsch, if you could come down, specifically Representative Hancock, if you want to phrase your question again for enforcement, and you might as well bring enforcement down at the same time, Mr. Conrad. And Representative Hancock, why don't you repeat? We have a handout in our packet.
Thank you, Mr. I'm still struggling, but thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hancock, would you rather them just talk about the handout? Or if you're
I can, I, it doesn't really hurt. It's just
oh,
I
ahead.
Have trouble enunciating and getting it out here. The basis for my question was just this. We are all interested in doing what we can to control the spread of invasive species. We realize that we need to try to find some silver bullets that aren't there, and that ultimately the zebra mussel and other invasive species are going to be the victors if we do not find that bullet. However, we are all interested in our best efforts, both from the DNR and enforcement, and in cooperative efforts from the COLAs and so on. And what I was really looking at, I'm just wondering basically if a bigger hammer, so to speak, is really going to be beneficial, or is it just going to take needed personnel away from other activities that might be more productive in the containment of the zebra mussel. So I was curious, and I see you have it broken down here, and you might just go through it a bit, but what I was alluding to was the fact that it appeared from the statistics that we have that warnings and citations and the distribution of those did not make a significant difference in terms of the infraction rates. And so I was trying to allude to the fact that some of the activities involved with invasive species are done on an involuntary basis. It's not something that people are willingly violating. And I would be, in terms of an enforcement, repeat offenders, I would be willing to really go after that. But someone that has inadvertently left a drain plug out, for example, where there is no species shown, and that's really not a lot of questions, but the area I don't want to go down is this that we think by punishing someone who is engaged in the activity that maybe he's not even aware of is good procedure in terms of controlling the species. We want to make sure that that activity is really valuable.
Director Hirsch or Colonel Conrad?
For the record, Jim Conrad, Director of Enforcement, Minnesota DNR. Mr. Chairman, Representative Hancock, the handout that I gave you basically summarizes our enforcement actions last year. And as you can see, there has been a definite increase in the number of not only citations but warnings that have been issued. That's a direct relation to the amount of time that we are putting into this effort. Not necessarily that there are more violations out there. Obviously, with our staffing that we have and the number of lakes, public accesses, number of boats in the state, we're not checking them all. So you can look at it and say that the incidence of violation is an 18% rate right now, but you have to take into consideration that we're checking very many more people than we have in the past, and obviously you're going to find that. Now, the focus of our enforcement efforts are always on compliance and education. And I think if you look at the ratio between the number of citations and the number of warnings, give you an idea, statewide, if you look across the whole spectrum of the enforcement activity that we do out there, we basically write one citation to every three warnings. We are still in a, you know, much more educational mode than a punishment mode. And in this case, you're seeing probably a 50% breakdown of warnings and citations. So we're even more interested in that that educational position at this time. But you get to the point, especially when you look at an 18% violation rate, and it only takes one violator to introduce one of these species into an uninfested lake, you know, there comes a time where you just have to start forcing compliance in some cases. And that's what we have been ramping up to do. That's what some of these additional legislative changes have provided us with the opportunity to ramp up some of those enforcement efforts and to give us some more tools to get that compliance. But the bottom line is, without the compliance of the users, without the voluntary compliance, because we can't force it on everybody with checks and that sort of thing, without that, like you said, the zebra mussels and the Eurasian milfoil are going to win.
Representative Hancock.
One quick follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you feel that the proposed increases in the fines for the violations would have significant benefit in terms of obviously it would increase funds available for it, but is it going to actually increase in the adherence to the policy?
Director Conrad.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hancock, you know, that might be a sociological question to be asked. Does a bigger stick get people to comply? You know, it's hard to give you a good answer to that, but in most cases, my feeling is that if the risk of a higher fine or higher punishment is out there, people will think twice. I mean, that's why we have graduated penalties when it comes to things like assault, you know, even murder. Death penalty, some people say, will lower the rates of murder. I'm not so sure about that. I'm sure there's a lot of you that will argue about that. But, you know, a $100 fine, somebody might think, well, I'll take the chance. But if it's a $200 fine, will that make you think twice before complying? I think there are people out there, regardless of how high the fine or penalty might be, will take their chances. We have seen that with the increase in our enforcement for baiting for deer. We started taking guns away and thought that might help. We're writing just as many tickets as before. We have some increased penalties for that as well. You know, it's something that you can argue up and down, but really it comes down to unless you get the buy-in from the user to be very good about compliance, you know, I don't know that any amount of penalty will get you there.
Representative Hancock.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair. I would tend to agree with you there. Is there an easy way for you to designate repeat offenders? I mean, these are the ones that I would be willing to say, you know, he's left his drain plug out once, but he does it a fourth time. Then let's get on them. But is that even possible that we can trace that in a relatively fast manner?
Mr. Director Chair, Hancock. Representative Hancock, currently no. We have a supplemental budget proposal. I'm not sure where it's at, but to get us a records management program for the division that we are, I mean, we're years behind other agencies where we can look up past violations and that sort of thing. Right now, there's probably a time lag of anywhere from 2 weeks to a month before those warnings and citations get entered into the system, and then the officer can only access those if he has internet access. So right now, we don't have the capabilities of identifying those repeat offenders so that we could intensify the enforcement actions on those individuals.
Thank you. And members, we are going over this quite a bit. I want to direct members to Section 7 is the civil penalties. It's my anticipation when this bill comes back, it will not include, and I'm worried I might be looking at it. Is the page number still the same? On Section 7, the civil penalty increases proposed by DNR, I anticipate will not be in the bill when it's brought before the committee. So if there's additional discussion at this point and it centers around their members' frustration with those increases, it's not my anticipation as author of the bill that they will be in there. I will qualify that to the one point Representative Hancock has mentioned it, and other members have brought it to my attention. they are interested in repeat offenders will be dealt with more harshly, which is on the last part, the civil citation part, those three lines of increase in penalty, I think, have more broad support. Next, we have, to this point, Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a clarification on that. So we're going to delegate the rulemaking for the penalties, or that's saying that if it's not included, there wouldn't be any changes?
Representative Kwan, when we bring the bill back, the bill's not before us now, but when the bill is before us, I was just letting people know, I think there's going to be more people voicing their frustration and hope that this is not included when we present the bill. I want to let people know. You're going to have to argue with your colleagues on the committee to add it back in and increase it, because it's my anticipation. I will not be bringing the bill with that sections in there. A number of folks within the committee have voiced that frustration. They did last year. It was removed by the House. It was put back in the Senate. We did not accept those penalties in conference committee, and it's my anticipation that's still the will of this body, and I was just trying to actually move the discussion along. To this point, Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think there probably is a general consensus that it's the repeat offender that is the thing that we've got to worry about right now. But the troubling thing to hear is that you don't have the capacity to track the repeat offender. So tell us a little bit about what it would take to do that and what the price tag would be.
Director Conrad, I think Representative Wagenius is still again talking about the long-range AIS plan and how different levels could do that. In that case, it was transferred to per boat fee, but we do have the dollar amounts. Do you want to elaborate on that discussion? Representative Wagenius.
I think it's we can put it off till later. It's fine. It doesn't make any difference, but I do think that we ought to understand that if we're going to have enhanced penalties for repeaters, which makes total sense, because they're costing citizens a ton of money, if we get zebra mussels, then my question is, what does it take to actually have those work? And if that is not part of the bill, and I'm just not aware of that, Mr. Chair, is it part of our plan to fund the process where we would find out who repeat offenders are or not? I don't understand that.
Well, Representative Wagenius, I think your bill, which is a proposal for additional funding in this area, when we consider that bill, which we will consider, we'll have, I think, some lively discussion around that point and how that can work, and maybe that's most appropriate at that time, unless one of the testifiers have a short comment in regards to Representative, because Director Conrad, you have not been here to address that. Director Conrad.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, we have been attempting to get a records management system for my division for several years now, ever since I became chief, as a matter of fact, and we keep coming up with shortfalls and budgets and that sort of thing. It is not something that is inexpensive to do the records management. Right now we're working off a computer program that's from the early 1990s. 91, I think, was the last time it was updated. And obviously technology has gone a long way beyond that. But the price tag is estimated to be anywhere from $450,000 to $750,000 just to get that up and running. And it's something that we are having a difficult time in trying to come up with that sort of funding under the current conditions budget conditions that we're constrained to.
Representative Wagenius.
Considering what happens to just one lake, if we get zebra mussels in it or something, When I say zebra mussels, it's always the shorthand for other aquatic invasives. But if we get zebra mussels, it's going to cost that lake more than that price. So, relatively speaking, that is not a high price if we have a better outcome for just one lake. So I think that's what we've got to be thinking about as we go forward.
Thank you. Representative Dill, to this point, and you are next on the list, so go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, you know, we had a fairly robust discussion about this last year, and I know we're talking about invasive species today, but I mean, this goes way beyond invasive species. I mean, this goes to ATVs, and this is every imaginable thing that, you know, and everybody that served on this committee with me knows that occasionally I have a rub or two up in my district with the way things are done, and Colonel Conrad and I have had a good time working together on those things, but really, we need to have, I can't imagine that everyone around this table couldn't agree to spend $750,000 on something so important to have people to know that if the person offends something in War Road, that when they're down in Slayton and they do the exact same thing, that in a matter of minutes they can identify that, whether it be on an ATV, whether it be shooting big game across a road. I mean, all the stuff we talk about in here, and we are in the 1991 mode. I mean, come on, let's find money and let's do it this year. Let's just get it over with. I mean, this just sounds like, it hurts when I do that. Well, don't do it anymore. Fix it, you know, or whatever the analogy might be. But it just seems to me that it's kind of ridiculous not to move forward. AIS, even if we didn't have this problem with the aquatic invasive species, we still need it.
Representative Dill, the entrepreneur in you is coming out. Representative Dill, you have the floor.
No, that's what I had. I mean, that is kind of frustrating for me, Mr. Chairman, is that, and I'll take the responsibility, because I mean, I would halfway led that conversation last year. To be honest with you, I thought the department was bird dogging it pretty heavily, and maybe they are. But I mean, if I have to go up, I wonder, is that a bondable thing, something like that? Is software, computer software, bondable? Does anybody know the answer to that?
The answer is
it is not.
It sounds like it may be. Why don't we find out if that is? I also remember Lieutenant Colonel Rodman Smith coming in talking about this at length. It's something I would imagine that at least could partially be funded out of Game and Fish. Clearly, it would be. But unfortunately, Game and Fish has been on hold for 11 years with no increases, and we're going to hear about that. And so there are opportunities, Representative Gill, to, as the governor said last night, work in a bipartisan way and find solutions, and this maybe is an opportunity for us.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd just be disappointed if we walk out of here whatever day we adjourn and we haven't got something figured out on this. So I mean, all I hear is everyone around the table saying what a crisis this AIS is. This morning I heard on the radio all the way in, and I sat in the parking lot out here listening to it for an extra 10 minutes about boat surcharges and people on the phone calling in, and you know, some outrage, some think it's a great thing. And I mean, here we are talking about $750,000 to manage people that are possibly chronic abusers of a system. I mean, let's get with it. Thank you.
Did former Representative Emmer have it on his radio show again this morning?
Yes, he did.
Okay, thank you. I was not aware of that. Thank you, Representative Dill. We'll have to probably live stream that or whatever, follow up on that.
Mr. Chair, I don't think it would, because we'd be here for the next 6 years discussing former Representative Emmer's 30 minutes on that subject.
Thank you, Representative Dill. Representative, I have Fabian, Draskowski, and Hanson, and we need to move on then. Members, we do need to whip through the MPCA's bill. There are some testifiers, and I have one testifier on this bill. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Conrad and Hirsch, for being here. On the handout that you have on the invasive species that Representative Hancock asked you to bring, in the fail to remove drain plug, and I just want to pick on that one, you might say, the number of stops that were made and so forth, can you walk me through, and Chair McNamara talked about Officer Smith, so walk me through Officer Smith walking up to my unit and Officer Conrad walking up to my unit, because I see that there are 321 written warnings and 379 citations.
realizing that in enforcement you have the opportunity to either write a warning or a citation, walk me through what determines what makes you issue a written warning and Officer Smith does a citation.
Director Conrad.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian. I was jumping ahead to Representative Draskowski there. The circumstances of the stop, there are a lot of things that go into the decision of writing a citation or writing a warning. Now, one of the things that doesn't show up on this is that early in the season, we were doing education, which meant writing warnings. Later in the season, as the word got out and, you know, there were article after article in the newspapers and, AIS and drain plugs and that sort of thing were beaten to death by the media, the expectation of people out there not knowing that they were violating, decreases. So the incidence of citations would increase as the season went on. One of the situations where I would write a ticket as opposed to a warning is if I ask the individual, did you know that that was a violation, and they say yes. I mean, a lot of it comes down to something as simple as that.
Follow up, Representative Fabian.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just that it's easier to get forgiveness than it is permission, I suppose. Thank you.
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Conrad, actually, Representative Fabian had the elements of my first question. When people are stopped, do you have a sense of whether they were intending to inoculate an area with AIS or, is there ever does anybody ever have that intention when you talk to them?
Mr. Chair, Representative Draskowski, it's, intent is a very hard thing to prove. In something as simple as leaving a drain plug out, unless the individual would say, I think that this lake should have zebra mussels, and then we're done with it. We don't run into that sort of situation. But what we do run into in making some of those decisions as well is that you have a non-infested lake that somebody is leaving with water, without removing the drain plug. They aren't going to infest another lake. So in that situation, I'd give them a warning the first time, obviously. If they're leaving an infested lake and they don't pull a drain plug, that's a much more serious situation, and the opportunity to infest another lake is there, obviously. So, those are some of the things that we go into, but to prove intent, that's pretty tough to do. In most cases, we don't just issue a citation. We talk to the individual first. And part of that conversation might be, do you understand, what you're doing here and what the possibilities are and whatever. And, in those cases where we have individuals who are truly clueless as far as the fact that they're violating, those guys are going to get a warning and some education. Those people that say, I knew it, and it's too much trouble for me to do this. We don't have a lot of sympathy for those people.
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Conrad, thank you. The most problematic part I see with the drain plug statutes that we have, and I see we're writing some more in here, is people who never intend to do any of this. You now have the authority to pull somebody over for having their drain plug in their boat within seconds after they pull out of their garage with their boat. That's what we've written into law. Two-part question related to that. How many people have you? Obviously, your focus is on enforcing this near the lakes and water bodies. How much have you exercised it in significant distances away from those water bodies, and how many of these people, if any, have had a dry bilge?
Director Conrad.
Mr. Chair, Representative Draskowski, I can't tell you statistics on that. But what I can tell you is that our officers, when they're driving to training to Camp Ripley, if they see a boat driving along Highway 10, headed south or whatever, they're not going to pull that boat over on Highway 10 and inspect them. We're not doing that. We are focusing on those locations where, we're close to public access, we're close to high activity lakes and that sort of thing. We're not pulling people over randomly on the highway that have drain plugs still stuck in their boats. We're doing it, like you said, with the close to the accesses, close to the points where the violation would have an impact on a lake.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hirsch, a couple questions for you. We're looking at how we approach this AIS thing, and certainly I maintain that we have about $280 million a year that we are taking from the people of Minnesota to protect our legacy. And $80 million of that at least would apply to this area. If there was a significant portion of that $80 million, would that be something that you think would have the potential to have a significant impact on this in the form of an education program?
Director Hirsch.
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, Steve Hirsch, Director of DNR Ecological and Water Resources. Mr. Chairman, Representative Drazkowski. Certainly any funding source, any dollars would be helpful in that regard. If I understood your question right, you're referring to the legacy funds, and the policy question of whether we should use legacy funds for this is something I think that needs to be discussed and needs to be weighed against what the constitutional requirements of that fund are. But we need funding to do these programs, so certainly any funding source would satisfy that requirement.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Hirsch, if we had a significant education program around that, ostensibly funded by legacy dollars, would we need to rely on enforcement as greatly?
Director Hirsch.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Drazkowski, this is similar to, a question that we talked about in the first day in committee that we discussed this, and it's a philosophical question that I don't think there's any right or wrong answer to, but what I pointed out, and maybe I would just refer to the other handout we provided to the committee with the graphs that Representative Lugenius asked for yesterday. I talked, about what's happened with zebra mussels, and if you look at that top graph there with zebra mussels, we really did quite well for a long time, and this is when we were really focused on information and education. We didn't really have many citations being written for AIS violations during this period, and it seemed as though the zebra mussels were kind of being held constant, mainly in the Mississippi, St. Croix, Minnesota rivers, the St. Louis River estuary, and Lake Superior. And then you can see in the early 2000s it started to increase, and then around 2008 we've just seen a really large spike in the slope of that line, and so that got a lot of folks thinking, including ourselves, that the emphasis on education, while we didn't want to abandon that, didn't seem to be enough to stop this increase in zebra mussels, and that's really what's resulted in a lot of the heightened concern that we've heard about the last few years. So at least from my personal opinion is we still, education is very important, but it gets to the point where we have to start asking ourselves, why is it that there are some people that still don't know about this? Because we've been talking about this now for the better part of two decades, and so at some point it seems like I don't want to abandon education, but it seems like we need to do more if we expect this trend, for example, in zebra mussels to change and get that line flatter than it currently is.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One last question. Thank you, Mr. Hirsch. I wonder about some of these invasives, whether you're talking about aquatic invasives, which is what we were talking about today, or others. And it's been mentioned, and I think we need to remember that we've got dozens of invasive species or more that have become part of what is normal for us today. Well throughout and back into our history, we lived through it, and part of this, I think, is people's reluctance to give in to something, in some cases, to things that are inevitable. I know I've heard from some of the best researchers that have come before this group in past years around the Emerald Ash Borer, and they talk about Ohio and Indiana and how that particular organism spread throughout those states. And I asked the question, is it inevitable that the Emerald Ash Borer is going to someday occupy all of Minnesota? The answer was yes. And I don't know if that's the same with some of these aquatic invasive species or not. I'm curious. Certainly you go to a lot of these research gatherings and conferences. What is, and we're, Mr. Chair, I apologize, we're getting a little bit off the track, but to what extent are some of these aquatic invasives inevitable? I don't know. Are we simply delaying what's inevitable, or is there really a chance that we can stop zebra mussels and some of these others from infesting every water body in the state?
Director Hirsch.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jaskowski, excellent question, and it really, in my opinion, and you could talk to five different professionals in this and get five different opinions, but I can give you my, I think the level of inevitability really does vary by species, and terrestrial species are particularly problematic, like the Emerald Ash Borer, because it's hard to stop, you know, the transport over land. But when you're talking about moving from one water body to another, then it really gets down to what's, you know, how easily is that species spread. For example, just to give you a few examples, we've had really very good luck in the state preventing the spread, human-induced spread anyways, of invasive species of fish like the round goby and the ruff, for example, which are in St. Louis River Estuary and Lake Superior. We've got very good regulations on the books, and the minnow industry and the private aquaculture industry, we've worked very well with them to prevent inadvertent spread of fish species. It's more difficult to accidentally spread a fish species. If you look at Eurasian water milfoil, for example, I would say that's a difficult one. And then if you look at spiny water fleas, they have a resting egg stage that resists freezing and drying. That's a really difficult one. But with zebra mussels, I think we could do a lot better with zebra mussels. It's really not that easy to spread zebra mussels, especially for a day user on a lake. The most likely way that a day user on a lake is going to spread them is if they come off a lake with zebra mussels and have vegetation, because zebra mussels will grow on the vegetation. But if you just take the simple precautions of clean draining and drying, I think it's really relatively easy to prevent spreading zebra mussels. And so I think we've got a chance with them to, you know, I don't think we could totally stop them from spreading to more lakes, but I think we've got a chance with zebra mussels to do a lot better than we are. So again, it really depends on the species.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Conrad, I want to circle back to enforcement, and I'm going to ask you a couple direct questions. It's been alluded in this discussion and other discussions that we have relating to permitting or things like that, that somehow enforcement is being done to pad the budget. And I'm going to ask you just directly, are you doing enforcement for funding?
Director Conrad.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, no.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought that was the answer. But the perception seems to be clouding this debate. And it gets tied up in different words relating to intent or purpose or awareness. And Mr. Hirsch talked about awareness and looking at the graph. That there's been general broad awareness or efforts to make people aware of how they could change their behavior. And over time, we've also tried things of training. And there are differences between individual, personal, recreational use and business responsibility of businesses that may have boats that are moving across. And then we have the challenge of tourism crossing the border, people who don't live in the state who may not receive that awareness training. And going only to the repeat offenders, I mean, we have plenty of history related to this, whether we want to take drunk driving or whether we want to take burglary or whether we want to take speeding. that you can have an impact on that initial violator by seeing if they have knowledge, not intent. And one way to have knowledge, I mean, so if I get pulled over by speeding for speeding, and I say, well, I didn't see that sign that said 55, that's probably not going to work. And if I do it twice, and I say, I didn't see that sign again, it's probably not going to work. And that your officers have the discretion to make that determination on site. Correct? Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson, that's correct. Yes.
Representative Hanson.
So, Mr. Chair, I think we keep trying to narrow down, which might be an interesting discussion if we were at the initiation of this problem. But we're not at the initiation of this problem. We're at the end of one generation of this problem. And so having enforcement goes in with broad public awareness, and if there's a certification component that's there for commerce, and if there was even a voluntary certification for individuals who wanted to go to the next level to learn more, if somebody had been through a training session on how to stop invasive species and you pulled them over and you could see that they've been at a training session, would you have proof then that they had knowledge?
Director Conrad.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson, yeah, that would give us indisputable proof that they had knowledge of the appropriate laws and ignored them anyway.
Representative Hanson.
And so, Mr. Chair, it's not intent, but it's knowledge. And I agree, Representative Drazkowski, there's probably not that much of purposeful, hey, I'm going to pick up the carp and carry it over into this lake. But there could be. And for that rare, extremely rare case, which we have the rare cases of somebody looking at the deer inside the fence, cutting the fence, going in, shooting it, and pulling it outside the fence, and running home with it, who would have thought somebody would do that? But they do. Is that correct, Mr. Conrad?
Mr. Director Chair, Conrad. Representative Hanson, correct, yes.
So this needs Mr. Chair, this needs an integrated response here that, again, we are not at the beginning of this problem. We're way into this. And so you have to have public awareness. You have to provide voluntary training or certification. You may have to have some higher level, and I think that goes into the docks and into the lifts or where there's commerce that moves from lake to lake. But I don't think you're doing enforcement or proposing higher fees to pad your budget. I think you're doing it because we have plenty of evidence throughout public safety that you have to have a variety of tools at your disposal and a variety of educational efforts that go on to change behavior.
Thank you, gentlemen, for coming today. Mr. Snyder from the Christmas Lake Homeowners Association would like to address us for a minute or two, and then we will have MPCA come down on House File 2164. Mr. Snyder, welcome. If you could identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. My name is...
2 minutes, and we'll show you a sign at 30 seconds left.
Okay. My name is Joe Schneider. I live in Chanhassen, Minnesota. Thank you again for letting me speak to your committee. My comments are only relative to human-transferred aquatic invasive species, so I'm not talking about the fight against Asian carp. I believe that our AIS prevention programs to date have been Minnesota nice. They're sacrificing the future state of our public waters for the convenience of our current population. That's not stewardship. Our future generations will not be able to experience the amazing 10,000 lakes as generations before us have done. The current approach of education, awareness, spot inspection, spot decontamination, and some control mechanisms like fines don't work. They haven't worked. And they're going to cause every popular lake to get every aquatic invasive species. And I think it's unconscionable. We have to get to an approach that meets the objective of 84D, preventing, not slowing the spread of aquatic invasive species. Let me say it again, preventing, not slowing the spread. Only one short-term solution proposed by Director Hirsch last week comes close to achieving that goal. You have to do a serious AIS inspection of every boat before it launches. You say that's too expensive, and I agree with you. To do it at every landing is absolutely too expensive. But there are ways that you can go through to lower the cost of delivering that same capability. Will it be 100% effective? No. Will it be dramatically more effective than anything we're proposing doing? Absolutely yes. The solutions are out there. We're not talking about rocket science for short-term solutions, but it takes leadership. Leadership to act, leadership to convince the public that it's the right thing to do. And this is unpopular, I know, but this is what we're looking for you to do as leaders. Last week I made three comments about things I think need to be done to the DNR's AIS bill. I ask you to do those things. Lastly, I urge you to move quickly. The open water boating season is about 8 weeks away. Please don't let down the future generations. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder. Questions? Thank you. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question, Mr. Snyder. How many boats would it take to infect a lake?
Mr. Snyder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski. The answer is one.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next we'll hear from the MPCA. Mr. Kredelka, are you the one going to present? This is House File 2164. Members, it includes a lot of things. I anticipate very much of it will be discussed today and probably not be discussed too farther past that. But Mr. Kredelka, if you could walk through the bill. We do have one other bill on today, but dependent on questions, it's Representative Wagenius says we were going to hear the information on that bill. It's a thought about limiting the purchase of land for prices over tax assessed value. So Representative Wagenius, we'll try and get to that today. It'll depend. I don't know if Mr. Kredelka feels he can do service in 20 minutes or do you want the full half an hour?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'll try to go as fast as I can. If you'd like more information, I can add it, but I'll try to keep the high points.
Well, Mr. Kredelka, what I would ask is that we will let you walk through the entire bill, and then depending on questions, we'll do it like that. And then additional information sought or testifiers will certainly let you know. And then when parts of this bill come back, we'll make aware of that. So, members, if you could just pay attention while Mr. Kredelka walks through it. Mr. Kredelka, if you could did you already identify yourself? If you could, that would be great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Kirk Kredelka. I'm the legislative director for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And I wanted just to go through House File 2164. It is the MPCA's policy bill. I know there was a handout that included some talking point, or just a walkthrough. And this is the document I'm really going to follow through as we go through the bill, and it explains the various parts. The PCA policy bill really has three parts. The first is changing a number of reports, some of them legislative, some of them reports between agencies. And what we're doing is consolidating them, repealing some of them, in other cases extending the frequency of when they're done. So if they're done every 1 year, it'll be every 2 years, every 4 years in some cases. So that's the one part of the bill. The second part of the bill is repeal of a number of obsolete rules. Each year the agency is required to do an annual obsolete rules report. These rules all have appeared in those reports over the last several years, and there are two options to get rid of them. One is to go through the rulemaking process, which takes additional resources and time, or ask the legislature just to outright repeal them. And we'll go through each of those in a little bit also. And the third piece are small policy changes or corrections. So just starting on the bill, Section 1. Section 1 and 2 are dealing with reports that the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency makes to the Environmental Quality Board on ground and surface water monitoring. EQB needs to do a 10-year water plan, and every 5 years they do a plan between on it. These reports help inform EQB to put together those documents. However, the statute right now requires it to be done every 2 years by MPCA and AG, and since we're changing ours to every 5 years, we've also proposed changing it for AG. This is already a number of years ago. This change was made for DNR, and we're just asking for the same treatment in this report. the information will still be there for UTV to do the reports that they need to do every 5 and 10 years. It just matches it up better. Section 3 deals with our citizen monitoring of surface water reports. This is a report that's currently done every 3 years. We're just proposing to change it to every 4 years. There really isn't that much, during that extra time, that much change between what is being reported, and this will just allow for a better and more meaningful schedule on this report. Section 4 and Section 18 deal with some of the long-range plans that the MPCA needs to do on air, land, and water issues. And right now, MPCA actually does a strategic plan every 5 years, which sets our long-term goal for the agency as a whole. Inside then, every 2 years or so, we do a business plan, and every 1 or 2 years inside that, we do program plans. And this is all something that was brought to the agency a number of years ago on some to run MPCA in some ways more similar to a business, to have that long-term planning in place. Our strategic plan is available on our website. It was last done in 2008. We're in the initial process of going through and renewing it as we would in the usual five-year schedule. So we're proposing to repeal the long-range plans we're required to do here for the legislature, because that same data is included in our strategic plan that's already available on the website. And so it's just creating some reports that duplicate each other. Section 5 is the start of some changes that we're making to our solid waste reports and our pollution prevention reports. Right now, there are a large number of reports out there that deal with these two issues, and a number of the dates are very confusing. They don't match up. And what we're proposing to do is a number of these reports, just consolidate them into two reports, solid waste report, which would be due every 4 years, and then on the alternate, every 2 years, there would be a pollution, every 4 years, again, a pollution prevention report. So we'd have two large reports that cover about 7 to 8 reports that are currently being done to the legislature. And they would alternate. So every 2 years, you'd have a solid waste report or the pollution prevention report. And this would allow for us to still provide that information to the legislature for policy decisions. And on Section 5, it's just starting that process of incorporating things incorrectly. Section 5 just deals with the e-waste report and making it part of the solid waste report from 1 year to every 4 year report. Section 6 deals with an internal report that the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and Department of Commerce does for the Department of Admin on a number of issues dealing with energy usage along with recycling and other sustainability programs. Currently, the similar information is shared on a more regularly basis with all agencies with the Interagency Pollution Prevention Advisory Team to carry out executive orders on state agency sustainability plans. And this executive order is something that has been renewed by Governor Dayton and by previous governors also. So this is just a better way for us to share this information with all state agencies instead of just Department of Admin. That's Section 6. Section 7, again, as you see here, is where we start consolidating the solid waste report that would be due every 4 years. In it will be the Metropolitan Landfill Abatement Report, the SCORE report, the Solid Waste report, and other materials that will in the Waste Management Act biennial report, which is actually being repealed later in the section. Section 8 starts our changes to the SCORE report. In 2009, the legislature required that the MPCA look at the SCORE report, which is a county report dealing with recyclable materials and other solid waste, municipal solid waste, to find ways to make the reporting requirements on counties easier and to make sure we had the correct and accurate information. And so the agency, in consultation with the Association of Minnesota Counties, the Solid Waste Administrators Association, the Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board, and others, started to work on this process to reduce the resources counties employ to collect the data, to ensure that estimate methods are consistent across all counties, and also to ensure the data is collected as accurate and useful for policymakers. Last year, the MPCA put together that plan with stakeholders' ideas, and there were a number of recommendations. It was presented to the legislature, and in it, it said that there were a number of things that we could do on our own to make changes, and we were starting to make changes on some of the reporting requirements. But there would be, at a future date, we would need to come to the legislature to make a number of changes. And that's what you start seeing here in sections 8, 10, 12, and 13 are those recommendations in that report last year are the changes here you see in the legislation to accomplish. Specifically, we do a a number of issues. Number one is we remove estimates on various areas when we start looking at recycling numbers, and that's what you're seeing in Section 8. Right now, there is a 5% credit if a county has a yard waste management plan. We would get rid of that credit. We would be collecting information on actual amount of yard waste that they're recycling, so we have better data for policymakers within the counties, MPCA, and the legislature. And the other one is a 3% credit for waste reduction efforts. There's a 3% there. Again, this is the idea, is to rely on actual information instead of estimates. Section 9, again, is just dealing with that solid waste report changes, where we're bringing other reports into it at the same time frame. Section 10 is the second part of our changes to the SCORE report. This deals with information that the MPCA was collecting from counties on their solid waste programs that we weren't using. So PCA never used the information, and after working through with the stakeholders, there's no reason for us to collect it, so we're just going to remove that, would like to remove that from statute, because it's just information on number of employees before that are doing the work right now, and their duties and their salary amounts. It's not something we use for any decision-making policy. The counties will still need to report to us on how they use the SCORE grant dollars. That information will still be available for everyone, decision makers and the public. It's just not details on FTEs, which are not being utilized by folks that we know of. Section 11, again, is the just coordinating solid waste reports into the solid waste, various solid waste reports in the solid waste consolidated report. Section 12 and 13 is the last change we're proposing to the SCORE reports. And this goes, again, with the thought that we need to collect information and make it easier for counties. Currently, right now, haulers and others need to report to each of the 87 counties their information on the tonnage of materials they're picking up. It would be much easier if they just had to report to one person. The goal here is to make it easier on the hauler. They report to one entity, the MPCA, instead of 87 the counties that they do business across the whole state. And this is information then that we could share with the counties as needed, the public, and ourselves in aggregate, so that information about a specific hauler is not necessarily passed on. Section 12, you see currently already those that deal with mixed municipal solid waste need to license with local units of government. We're just proposing a registry list of those that only do recycling. For instance, there's a company right now that only deals with recycling. It would not need to be licensed through the cities. We're trying to create a list so that when we yearly go and ask folks for information on how much material is being recycled, we know who they are. This is not something that they would have to pay a fee for. This is not something we would put additional requirements on. This is a way that we, every year, we know who we need to contact to get the information for. I know right now it says register. If there's a better word that alleviates any concerns about fees in that, that would be open to discuss that. Section 13 then deals with the type of information that we would be requesting from those haulers that are licensed locally or through the state on the above section. Again, trying to get the actual data to one source, the MPCA, instead of spreading amongst the counties, and again, trying to get the best possible data. We have talked to some folks that would like some more information and have some questions on whether this is the correct stuff that needs to be collected, whether this stuff is easy to acquire, and so we are setting up meetings with folks to continue that discussion. Section 14 is really just a technical change with the toxic pollution prevention plans. In the mid-1990s, Governor Carlson changed it that the MPCA at that point was receiving the pollution prevention progress report, and changed so that information would now be reported to the Department of Public Safety and became part of the toxic release reports that are already being sent to the Department of Public Safety. Back in the mid-90s, there was an effort to make a legislative change. It never was accomplished, and since then, every governor since then has approved an executive order that just changed the date to what it's putting here in statute, and that the information goes to public safety and not PCA. So this is just making the statute books follow what is current practice to make it easier for folks. Section 15, again, is that larger consolidation of our solid waste reports. This is the second report that I mentioned dealing with prevention issues. So this report would now deal with the base of the report is the toxic pollution prevention evaluation, which is something that we actually just provided to the legislature a couple days ago. Our e-waste report and any other product stewardship programs that we have, we would report in this. For instance, right now there is a system set up for recycling rechargeable batteries. This would be a report where we would update the legislature on those efforts to provide information. Not something that we have a request for an annual report to do right now by legislature, but it's important information that we would like to provide the legislators so that they know what is going on. And then also information in the toxics and packaging report that currently exists would also, some of that information would go into this report, and the individual report would be repealed. It's later noted in the repeal. Section 16 is our annual pollution report. We're asking just the changes from an annual report to a biennial report. So it would be before the legislature at the beginning of every new biennium. The reason is a number of the pieces of data in here, especially on the air emission side, is not collected every year. It's something that's collected every other year or every 5 years. So a number of times the report looks very similar from year to year. The idea would be just to change it to a frequency that better reflects when there's actual data changes. It would still be there to provide for the legislature and the public information on discharges and emissions rates. Section 17 is the first of our policy proposed changes. Currently, there is a prohibition on new open-air swine basins, except for the certain carve-out that's in here already, the exception. That is due to sunset on June 30th in June 30th of 2012 of this year, and we're proposing just to extend it another 5 years. This is a piece of language and statute that has, in previous times, the sunset has come up to expire, and we have renewed it at different increments. So this has been done before, and we're just continuing that trend. We have discussed this issue with the pork producers also that would be affected by this, and our understanding is they are fine with this change. Section 18 is dealing with some of the additional long-range plans that I talked about before, where we're repealing the plan, but we have a strategic plan that contains this information already, so that we're just not creating duplicate reports. Section 19 is a report that we currently do every 2 years, dealing with the activities of the Midwest Interstate Low-Level Radioactive Waste Compact Commission. This is a report on a number of Midwest group of states dealing with low-level radiation waste, stuff from hospitals and other things. This is not dealing with any of the nuclear facilities within the state. When this report was first created, there was a situation where it looked like a number of states, including Minnesota, would not have a place to dispose of these materials. So a Midwest commission was created to create a location for these materials to be stored. This report was to update the legislature on those activities. Since then, that situation has changed. Minnesota companies and producers of this type of waste have outlets to take care of it and dispose of it correctly. And at this point, there has been no activity with the commission. So we propose changing the report from every 2 to every 4 years. And if the situation were to arise where that ability for our Minnesota businesses to dispose of this waste, we would report to the legislature any change in the situation before the next report. We would update them in a quicker manner. Section 20 is a technical change and correction. Last year, there was a change on when environmental review was done for ethanol plants for environmental assessment worksheets. During that discussion partway through, biobutanol facilities was added to the language. However, it wasn't added in two additional spots. This is really just a technical correction. We've talked to the stakeholders that put it in the rest of this section and through 14.6 through 14.24 about this, about adding it to the rest of that paragraph. There was no concerns. The Senate had an amendment on the Chamber's permitting bill that made the exact same change also. Section 21 is the start of some changes we're proposing to the greenhouse gas legislative report. Section 21, 22, and 25 is where you'll see these changes. Currently, there are two reports that must be done to the legislature. One is an annual report where the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, along with the Department of Commerce, makes recommendations to the legislation to the legislature on possible legislation. There's also a every two-year report that updates the status of efforts to reduce and control greenhouse gases. We're proposing that the reports just be made into one and be due every 2 years so that they're on the same cycle. Currently, when these two reports do match up, we do combine them into one report. This will just remove one of the annual reports. That is section 21 and 22 where you see that changes. Section 23 along with section 24 again is changing with our solid waste report. This actually deals with some abatement activities in the metropolitan area that were reported every 4 years in the solid waste report, along with the fund use of dollars in the landfill abatement accounts. We do not change the annual report dealing with the metropolitan landfill contingency action trust fund activities, which deals more with existing landfills already there, and our MPCA and others are working on ensuring that they don't close landfills that don't cause any harm to public health or to the environment. That's the end of the language. However, there's a number of things in the repealer here that I just would like to walk folks through just so they understand. This is also the section that deals with a number of the obsolete rules that we are proposing on removing. So I'd like to just start going through online 19.2, that first citation, 115.447, is the repeal of our annual tracking report for new wastewater facilities. This is a report that's done right now that catalogs compliance issues with every new wastewater facility over the last several years. It's information that we currently have in other forms that we can share with folks at any point. It's not something at this time that we've had much or any inquiry on, and believe that we can cover the information along on needs for future wastewater facilities through our wastewater infrastructure needs report and the compliance issues through our returnal reports that we can share with folks at any time that it's requested. The second citation, 115A.07, is our Waste Management Act report. This is something that's being repealed. Information that's currently in this report, some of it would be located in our solid waste report. This report is a remainder of the Office of Environmental Assistance that a number of years ago was rolled in to the MPCA. They had a separate report when they were a separate entity to report on their activities. Now that we are one agency, it would all be done in the solid waste report, that information. The third one here, 115A.15, subdivision 5, is actually something that we would like to have an author's amendment at a later date to take out. We do amend this section of statute in the bill, so we would not want to delete the amendments that we propose in the bill. It's just a technical error on our part when we drafted the bill. 115A.965 is, as I mentioned before, is the toxics and packaging report that is being repealed. That data would all be included in the pollution prevention report every 4 years. And the last statute citation there, 216H.07, deals with the greenhouse gas annual report to the legislature, which we would propose merging into our biannual report to the legislature to create one report. Now we come upon the obsolete rules. As I mentioned earlier, these rules were collected by the agency when we do our annual obsolete rules report. The first citation here, dealing with 7002.0025, deals with air permits. We just finished up a rulemaking at the request of the legislature implement the new application fee rule. We, at that point, did not repeal this out of the existing air permit rules. We're looking just to get rid of that. The next piece here, dealing with Minnesota Rule 7011.7030, deals with an obsolete rule dealing with brick and structure clay products that have been vacated by the U.S. District Court of Appeals. So where we would also be pulling it from our Minnesota rules. Next citation dealing with the rule 7021. A number of sections there deal with the state's acid rain program. The state had a program that was existence prior to the federal program. When the Clean Air Act amendments in 1990 were passed, the federal program was created, and which is currently doing a very good job in the issue, and there's no need for the state requirements on the law since we must follow the federal requirements. And then the last issue just deals with some land application of sewage sludge management rules. In 1997, we went through and made a number of changes. The pieces here that we are looking to repeal are pieces that were meant to transition from the old to the new rules that no longer are needed since the new rules are fully being implemented. That is the bill. If there's any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Kadalka. Mr. Quillis, why don't you come down? I've got you on the list of testifiers. You're here. Why don't we do that, and then if we have time, we'll go to questions. I have Representative Amius on the list. Mr. Quillis, you could identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tony Quillis. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Just very briefly, we wanted to commend the agency for all their hard work in putting together this proposal to reduce, remove, and combine a number of reports. But just wanted to bring attention to the committee a couple of sections that we have concern with. And the first one being Section 10, which deals with getting rid of some of the score reporting. We think that some of those specific reporting requirements are very important to where those score dollars go for and provide some accountability. So we'd like to talk to the agency about that. Sections 12 and 13 of the bill create some new requirements for registration and some new reporting requirements on some new reports for the solid waste haulers of the state. As Mr. Kadelka has pointed out, we're going to meet with the agency on these concerns. So I just wanted to make sure that that the committee was aware of that, but I just wanted to point these out very quickly. But Section 12 requires some new registration. Section 13 requires some new reporting requirements by after that registration is ensued. Section 15 of the bill combines seven reports regarding pollution prevention and product stewardship. We just would like to walk through the agency on with those a little bit more and get a little bit of a better understanding. We think that some of those can be done without legislation, but I said we're going to have a conversation with the agency and hopefully figure out where those are going. And then finally, Mr. Chairman, the last one is when we talked about combining Section 22, some of the greenhouse gas reporting requirements. We have some questions about those. We'd just like to get answered with the agency and see if we can get a little bit of a better understanding of combining those two reports.
Thank you, Mr. Quillis. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have questions about two sections of this bill. Is that what you want?
Go ahead, Representative Wagenius.
Okay. In general, you know, consolidating some of these reports is a great idea, and so that's fine, but there's some loss that in two sections that I see that I really question. And one is in Section 8. You said that you are... and I'm looking at lines 7.6 on, that you want to report just what is actually happening and not give credits for activities. And the reason that that was done years ago was to make sure that people had opportunities to recycle. And that's when we were setting up recycling programs. What is being lost here is a substitute for making sure that those opportunities to recycle are available. And I say that with one assumption, that it's always been an assumption that I have heard and believed that people recycle if there's an opportunity. Now, if the agency finds that there's something different, then I think it's important that we know that opportunity to recycle is no longer operative. I mean, because that seems to be the assumption underlying this repeal of this particular section. So that's something I would like to understand from the agency. That's one thing. Because I see we're running out of time, Mr. Chair.
Well, Mr. Kadelka, I would recommend with all the repealers, and I had asked all the agencies that are under the purview of this committee to evaluate what reports, because it's, I've been overwhelmed by them. And so some of these have been at my push to ask them to evaluate. So Representative Wagenius, you've got some experience in this area. I guess I would ask Mr. Kadelka to meet with you and understand your concerns that you would have in this area, specifically on the recycling one. I hope after deadline to bring Renville County in. Renville County has had a terrific recycling rate. For us in the metropolitan area, we should be embarrassed at their success, being a rural county with dual sorting, and we have single sort in a lot of it. And so we're going to hear what in the world have they been able to do, and are they spending a lot more money than us, or what that's about. So we are going to talk about that specific issue and the successes they've had. Representative Wagenius, last point, and then we're done.
Okay. Well, the last section is on the section 16 on page 12, and you only want to do that report every other year. That seems wrong to me, and here's why. The air report is actually quite good. The water report has been weak, but now we're spending tons of money on water. And we need to know the outcomes of what we're getting for all this water money that we're spending. And I saw the recent report that you all did on outcomes for water, and that was directed kind of at a sixth grade level, and it may be good for, you know, the general public. I'm not sure that that's true, but I kind of think the public is a little more sophisticated than that. But that does not substitute for a professional level report, and this is the professional level report. And when we're spending hundreds of millions of dollars, or at least, yeah, hundreds of millions of dollars, we've got to have better reporting because of the money involved. So it seems to me that this would be a terrific loss, that Minnesotans would not understand what they're getting for their clean water money. And that's that I worry about.
Thank you, Representative Wagenius. And I think Mr. Kadelka will take our suggestion to meet with you over those concerns and to meet with the chamber. Seems like my idea to do some streamlining has Representative Wagenius in the chamber lockstep as usual. So at this point, we are going to have one more question from Representative Torkelson.
Not a question, Mr. Chair, but a correction. You mentioned Renville County as being the county with high recycling. It's actually Redwood County. I do not represent Renville County, but I do represent Redwood. I'm very proud of the work they do, and I'm sorry to have to step on your toes, but it is Redwood.
I forgot. Representative Shoemaker has a proposal that's Renville and Redwood County bonding proposal, so I had met with those people from both counties. Thank you for that correction. Members, we're adjourned.